supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. You know, I don't know about you, but I hear all the time about making sure we have a living will, that our loved ones know what we want. We hear it over and over, yet who really wants to think about how our lives will be at the very end? My guest is Nina McKissick. She's an RN who spent many years working in hospice, and she says that the end of life can be a time for healing and a time for love. Nina McKissick, welcome to the show.
Hi, Dan. Thank you.
If you want to join the conversation, we would love to hear from you. 1-888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Give us a call if you or a loved one has had experience with hospice, whether it's positive or negative. And call us if you have any questions about the process and how it works. I certainly have a lot of questions, and this is good because I'm the interviewer and you're the guest. So most of us, Nina, understand that hospice means palliative care, ideally in one's own home towards the end of life. Is that an oversimplification?
Yes. Thank you. Hospice is a specialized team of people who are no longer going, when you are no longer trying for the cure and your disease has left you or illness has left you with symptoms, then you come onto our specialized team. So just think about your day, your weeks and months and years may have been, you know, going to the hospital, getting treatments, getting poked and prodded, going to doctor's office visits, and just your deflating exhaustion at times. Now that you've had this discussion, hopefully, with your physician and your family, you can come onto our special service. And it is, we will take care of your symptoms. And so many times when we take care of your symptoms, let's say pain, then your quality of life gets so much better. And with that, we can start addressing some of the spiritual parts, possibly. Every family, every person has a constellation of differences, and everyone's different, and so we have to tune into that. So
I want to go all the way back now to one of the first few words you said about when it's time to stop pursuing the cure. It's a simple sentence.
It is a simple sentence.
But when is it time? How do we make that decision? Who makes that decision? What are the implications of that decision for everybody involved, including the doctor? Now, I know they come to you, they come to hospice after the decision is made. But I just have a guess that you're pretty knowledgeable about that process.
Yes, and the doctors, see, it's very different now because most of the doctors are specializing, and you don't get a lot of general practitioners. And when someone's seeking a cure for their illness, they are with these specialists who take care of one part of them. So many times the doctors do not understand the Medicare hospice benefit. And they are, and I have compassion for doctors. They have, many times they are afraid of lawsuits and they don't have these discussions. So my suggestion is if you're going through treatment and you get that little inkling that maybe this isn't going to work, this treatment, then you should start having that very important and difficult discussion sometimes about what are we going to do if it doesn't work. And a lot of people have, and this is when you can call the social worker who specializes in it. You have a patient care representative. You may have spiritual supporters to help you through this discussion.
I want to be pretty concrete here. And by the way, I just want to mention as an aside, I was recently on a panel with Patrick Kennedy, Ted Kennedy's son, who's all about services for people with mental illness. And he says of doctors, he says, you have to get a checkup from the neck up. So doctors need to ask their patients, how are you doing? How's your life going? How's your marriage? How's your job? How's your family? Those things. And for people who are that ill near the end, you know, doctors have to be able to say, what do you want now? What's right for you? How is your life going?
And not have an agenda while they're asking that question.
Whoever heard of that?
But, you know, Dan, it reminds me sometimes of when you were a little kid and you went to, you wanted something and you went to your mother and then she said, go to your father. And let's say, for example, someone, you have a 92-year-old woman on who has heart disease and her heart sounds like a broken, you know, lawnmower engine. And you call her cardiac doctor or heart doctor. And she or he says, you know, that's my heart. Don't touch it. And you can't, don't go near it. So it's kind of, but I just think that the doctors, I don't know how to mandate that they understand this.
So let's talk about when it's time.
Okay.
When it's time to call in hospice. What do you do? Who do I call? If it's me, who do my loved ones call? Will the doctor know who to call? Do they look it up in the, I was going to say yellow pages. Do we go to Google?
Yes, you go to Google. There is a website, oh gosh, I think it's CSM website, where they ask, it's a Medicare website, where they tell you, it's just basic what the regulations are. But I want to impress upon people that coming on to the hospice program, it's revocable. You can get off of it. Sometimes if someone's symptoms are taken care of, then their lives are so much better. Their quality of their lives are better. They're up visiting people, going to the hairdresser, driving, and they can go back onto their regular insurance. And but you asked when or who to go to.
I mean, what I'm hearing so far, Nina, feels really burdensome to the family.
It is, and it's very burdensome to the family and to the patient.
And isolating.
It's very isolating.
They have to make the decision. They have to look up hospice, and they've got no way of knowing what a good hospice is, what the right one. And there's no help.
Yeah, sometimes you do have. That's where you call in the social worker and patient representatives to have that discussion. And there, if you have a chaplain or some, but it is you are pretty alone in this decision, and it's a burden for the family. That's why you almost want to have this discussion when everyone's healthy.
So we call in hospice, and you keep referring to Medicare.
Yes.
What about if somebody's 40 years old?
Yes, they also use, they revert to Medicare. It's called the benefit program, and Medicare will be a supplement to their regular insurance. And we have infants. We have
Listen, if you're just tuning in, we're talking with Nina McKissick. She's a hospice nurse, and she's written From Sun to Sun. It's an incredible book, and we're gonna get to that soon. I really did. I love the book, and I'm actually not going to charge you for that part. Maybe not.
I could put my money away?
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, our number is 888-477-9499. Give us a call if you've had experience with hospice, positive or negative, or if you've got questions about hospice and how it works and what it means. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Nina, I'm going to pick up on something you said in your dedication. You said there can be great healing within the dying process. Explain.
Yes. When someone is stripped of their bodies, their bodies are no longer trustworthy, and we had those delicate conversations about, and we approach them with gentle eyes and an open heart, and we just see where the person, how they operate their life. We can do wonderful exercises or prayers about forgiveness, and we discuss. We discuss things like that.
Tell us what it looks like. I mean, give us an example.
Once you establish a relationship with a patient, they know you, they can trust you.
Are you there, daily, weekly?
It depends on how ill they are. It goes from once a week to three times a week to every day. Sometimes people are there, we have twice a day. But it depends on how close they are or else how their symptoms are out of control, and we just go in there every day to check them. So we establish a relationship, and I'll just keep it light, and I'll say, I've been doing this a long time, and sometimes, this may resonate with you. Perhaps there's a little bit of problems in the family with forgiveness, or someone really insulted another person. If you want to explore that, I'll be happy to tell you what I have seen.
So go on.
Oh, and then I will. I'll put my hand. I'll ask them first if I could touch them, of course. And I'll put my hand on their heart, and I'll just say, and I'll just look at them, and I'll just make sure I keep checking in with myself that I am not. I'm not have this big agenda, and they don't have to do anything. And that my heart is open and just loving them. Even when we're in a family that is spinning out of the universe, we have to be able to remain in our center. And I will say to them, you can picture your loved one, their face, someone you may have harmed. And picture their face in your imagination. And then if you would like to, if you're able to, bring their face down into your heart. And let's just concentrate. Close your eyes if you want to and look at them. And then ask them, for whatever I've done to you with my thoughts, words, or actions, I ask you for forgiveness. And then we can do that with forgiving yourself also for anything you picture yourself. And then we just breathe through it, and we just look at each other.
So I want to follow up with another thing you said in your introduction. You said that traditional thinking is that the way we have lived is the way we die. But how about if we lived as a selfish SOB? And you said there can be healing in that process. So if I've lived as a selfish person, is there healing? Do I have to die alone and angry?
You don't know. You don't have to. I mean, I'm not there to change them, but when I see a family or a person that is, there's such a component to suffering that is spiritual, and I'm not saying religious, that And I'm not there to fix them. I'm just, and I speak about myself. I speak about the entire team.
Yeah.
To alleviate with little suggestions. Okay, if the person's an SOB, yeah. Alrighty. you know that mostly comes from their fear of a loss of control. And sometimes when I get a patient alone, the conversation is very different. You'll get someone who's ranting and raging at the family. Everyone's afraid of them. And then you get them alone and you say, hey, you know, I notice your daughter kind of backs away from you. What's going on there? And this and that. And you just have this talk, very human talk with them. And then you find out, you deconstruct the behavior. And many times it's just old stuff from fear. And they don't know what to do without the anger.
Yeah.
They can't imagine life without it. So I've proved it.
And now that they're dying, and they really are out of control of everything, it could get better, it could get worse.
Yes, it could get worse. There are people who do not leave that. And, sometimes I've had people who go into the comatose state and their families can finally approach them. I mean, I'm laughing, but it's just holy moly. It's amazing.
It's safe to love them.
Yeah, when they're
again.
In a coma.
Yeah.
But every family has a constellation of acts and thoughts and...
Yeah.
And
yeah. Let's go to the phones.
All right.
We've got Cindy on the line. Hi, Cindy.
Hi there.
Hi, Cindy.
Thank you for taking my calls. This is a really interesting program.
Oh, super.
So I lost both of my parents, and when my mother died, this is early 1991, and I was actually hoping things may have gotten better without hospice care, but it doesn't sound that way based on the conversation thus far. We were really lost as a family. She was in the hospital. She was suffering from stage 4 lung cancer. And, literally with a month left in her life, doctors were scheduling all different kinds of therapies for her, and they were still drawing blood and doing tests because she had had a stroke based on her chemo. And as a family, we just didn't know. We thought it was to give us hope, like that there was a possibility of recovery, when clearly to anyone outside of the situation, that's not the case. That wasn't the case. And it was a very painful experience.
And did you...
And then with my dad, we had hospice care with him, and it was just... It felt so human and so civil. And I think that the word empathy was used earlier.
Yeah.
And it just became, we understood how to feel as a family. It helped my dad. It helped us.
Cindy,
an incredible experience.
Let me keep you on the phone just for another 30 seconds. Tell us what hospice care looked like in your family. Not its impact, but concretely. Was it at your house?
Well, it was not at our house. My dad was suffering from late-stage Parkinson's, so he was in a nursing facility.
Right.
Heavy care.
So what did the hospice nurses do?
The nurses came every single day to visit with him and with us. We were there every day. And they really... not only checked on him to make sure he was getting the proper palliative care, but they also checked in with us and really helped us understand where exactly our dad was in the process, what we could expect going forward, and also how to talk to him. He was not able to talk to us anymore at the very end, but how to talk to him and... That has benefit, and telling him that it was okay for him to go. You know, things that, from an outside perspective, when you're not right in all of the emotion and the feeling, may sound very logical, but when you're right in there,
you need
that guiding hand. It makes you feel like you're doing the right thing, you're doing the best you can, and somebody is acknowledging that and helping you through
it. You really need that from the outside. Cindy, thanks so much
Thank
for
you,
your
Cindy.
Call. Thank you. Thanks for the mm-hmm. education.
Thank you.
Too. That's quite a story. Mm-hmm. So when we come back, we've got to take a break. When we come back, I want to talk to you a bit about the role of education.
Mm.
Cindy really brought it up. Mm-hmm. That's very important.
Yes.
And I want to share with you a couple of several experiences I've had being the death's midwife with mm-hmm. my patients, with my sister.
Oh, wonderful.
So we'll take a short break. We're talking with Nina McKissick. She's an RN and a hospice nurse who's written From Son to Son. We're talking about hospice care, end of life, compassion, understanding, humanity, and love here. If you want to join the conversation, we're at 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY-FM.
The Wan Institute supports WHYY and offers graduate programs in acupuncture, Chinese herbal medicine, and applied meditation at its Glenside location. Applications and information are online at woninstitute.edu.
Proudly supporting WHYY is Camp Hill Special School, an accredited Waldorf school with day and boarding options dedicated to redefining what is possible for children and youth with special needs. Students not only contribute to their class communities, but the community as a whole, taking part in festivals, starring in plays, caring for animals, participating on student council, and fulfilling meaningful roles in their on-campus homes, offering a campus tour on May 20th at 9 a.m. Details at camphillspecialschool.org.
Bad energy habits around the office can affect your bottom line. PICO Smart Ideas for Your Business can help with customized tips, information, and programs designed to save you energy and money. Learn more at pico.com/smartideas. PICO supports WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host, talking with hospice nurse Nina McKissick. Nina, we heard previously about the importance of education, not just care and nurture through the process, but education, learning about what's going on with our loved one who's dying and with the family.
Mm-hmm.
Is that large part of what you do as a nurse?
Oh my goodness, yes, and every home or every facility you go into is different. You say, you learn how to say the same things many different ways after you, depending on who you're speaking to. So education is of utmost importance. And that is when the breakdown occurs and people start suffering also, is when they really, truly don't understand what they could be doing to alleviate their suffering, and the family is there. Everyone's out of sorts, and everyone, either they're exhausted or overwhelmed, and so we need to really make sure gently that they understand what we're talking about.
I told you before I wanted mm-hmm. to talk about my one experience being a death's midwife. It was with a patient named Carolyn, and I use her name intentionally. It was mm-hmm. her real name. She came. She had, I believe it was liver cancer.
Mm-hmm.
But she wanted to be aggressive mm-hmm. with it.
Sure.
And she wanted to work out relationship issues with her ex-husband, problems with her daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, in the back of her mind, she knew she was dying. And at the time, my sister was dying.
Mm.
And I had a feeling Carolyn was going to go first. So I said to her, I'll help you with your stuff. And maybe then you can help me with the dying process. We can talk about that and learn about it together.
Wow.
And I helped her with her stuff. And then we talked about death and dying and what it was like for her moment mm-hmm. to moment, the good news and the bad news.
Mm-hmm.
We had her family come in and talk about the process. Then I get a call at 5 o'clock on a Sunday morning, and it was her daughter saying, it's time. Mm-hmm. And they put the phone to Carolyn's ear, mm-hmm. and I said, honey, how are you? Which is an odd thing to ask somebody who's dying.
It's sincere.
Yeah.
And, go ahead and say
she
it.
And she said, I'm fine. Mm. And those were the last words I heard from Carolyn.
Nothing.
Carolyn was a landscape architect mm-hmm. when she was working. And a couple of days later, I gave a free talk mm-hmm. out at Friends Hospital, psychiatric hospital in Northeast Philly on the boulevard there. But they're well known for their botanical gardens. They're magnificent. Mm. So instead of payment, they gave me these beautiful flowers. And I've got a garden now outside of my office window called Carolyn's Garden.
Oh.
And how the process was really mm-hmm. healing for both of mm-hmm. us. Mm-hmm. So it raises a question mm-hmm. about you, Nina. Mm-hmm. What does this work do for you, mm-hmm. positive and negative?
Oh, that's a wonderful story. Thank you for sharing it with me. When I have a tendency to, obsess over aging, just my weight, my this, my that. And I said, wait a minute. And I'll go to someone's home who is very, very ill, and they'll look at me with sincerity and say, hey, how did it go a couple of days with you at that tournament? And I'll say, Nina, they're my wonderful teachers. I really honor their teachings to me, whether it's not all lollipops and roses all the time. But they are my teachers. They teach me how to love. They teach me how to sit and be quiet and observe. They teach me how to not be attached to an outcome. And they teach me that the gentle humor, how humor is so important.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my goodness. I can't tell you the laughter, the funny things that have happened at the end. Oh, it's just hilarious.
The New York Times columnist David Brooks just published a book called The Road to Character.
Oh.
But in it, he talks about two kinds of resumes. And one is the resume we traditionally think about,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The ones with all, I accomplished this and I did. The other resume is the one people say about you at your funeral. And he said, mm-hmm. most people build the first resume.
Mm-hmm.
He said, but if you want a better life, you work on that second resume.
Mm.
And you devote your life to service
mm-hmm.
and caring for others. And it's not about me.
Mm-hmm.
It's about what our responsibility, we say, in Judaism and in most Judeo-Christians, religions,
mm-hmm.
make the world a better place. Help others. And that's what you do, and mm-hmm. that's the payoff.
Mm-hmm. For it. Well, I think there's a bit of a difference between helping and serving. When you help someone, you have a feeling of satisfaction. Like, I helped mm-hmm. that woman out of poverty. I helped mm-hmm. that man to learn how to read. There's almost a feeling of satisfaction.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
when you
word.
Serve, you take your good parts, your broken parts, your dark parts, your light parts to them, and together, you are not when you help someone, you see someone as helpless.
Yeah.
And so it's service, so different when you look at service.
Service is more intimate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I remember back in the old days when I used to have broken parts and dark parts, mm-hmm. back when I was a regular human. I've outgrown that. Let's go to the phones. We've got Rick on the line. Hi, Rick.
Hi, Dr. Gottlieb. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Funny to have this program on. My father passed away a few weeks ago. And, I've been, we had to make a decision in the ER like a week before he passed away, whether to take him off life support. And I had, well, both upon his death and at that moment, he actually squeezed my hand in the ER, I do believe. I think the doctor was a little skeptical on that, but it was down to my wife, my brother's wife, my brother, and two doctors were all like, he really should be taken off life support. And I stayed with it, and, you know, to this day, I constantly think, boy, was it the right decision, you know? And that there was that hand squeeze, and his death was, I use the word beautiful, it was... I was there. A chaplain came in. She talked with me, my nephew, for a while. We told pretty much funny stories, and my nephew left. And my chaplain said, "Can we say a prayer?" I had to leave, and we stood around my father. We all held hands. The chaplain, myself, and my father, and she said this beautiful prayer. I joined her in the Lord's Prayer at the end of it, and I kissed him on his forehead, and right before that, I told these stories of my years of holding his hand, mm-hmm. and my fond memories of walking down the canal towpath, and I remember holding his hand, and here I am holding his hand 45 years later, and I told her a little joke he played on me once where he snuck under the canal and told me he jumped across, it was funny, and I kissed him on his head and said he could leave. And two tears rolled down his eyes, his expression relaxed, and wow. The chaplain says, "Oh my God!" And it was like, "Hey, I knew he heard me, you know." So,
sure.
Hey, Rick,
you know, sure did.
Hey, Rick, with all due respect,
yay, Rick,
I'm not hearing a ton of guilt and second guessing. I mean, I could be wrong, but what I'm hearing is great love and
yay,
joy.
To you. Yes, to your family.
So I'm missing something.
So we kept him on life support. I wonder constantly, yeah.
Yeah, well, Nina, can you cure Rick of his...
Grief has many faces. And one of the faces of grief is trying to figure out whether you did the right thing. And sometimes it exhibits itself in blaming others. And, you know, that doctor should have... He told me there were 6 more months, this and that. And perhaps... The questioning and beating yourself up a bit is you not going through, you know, that going through that the grieving process. And you can do whatever you want. I don't think there's any kind of set schedule for it, but set pattern. But just ask yourself if my worrying about whether taking him off or not is really enhancing my life here on Earth. And you could answer that question, but I want to congratulate you for doing so much loving and living.
Yeah.
Yay!
Yeah, you had
go.
great guidance. I, mm-hmm. Rick, I wish you the best.
Me too.
And
yeah.
You know, at these difficult decisions, mm-hmm. you know, we worry about, is this the right moment?
Mm-hmm.
Should it be the next moment or 3 moments after that?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what is the right moment? And there is no right moment, you know? And, and a few moments, I believe, a few moments one way or the other doesn't matter that mm-hmm. much. It certainly wouldn't matter in my life. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't want my family to worry about whether... You know, they did it a day too soon or a day mm-hmm. too late. You mm-hmm. know, I mean, your dad lived a full life, mm-hmm. and he obviously had lots of love in his life. I don't know that he or most of us would worry about whether it was mm-hmm. a day too soon or mm-hmm. a day too late.
Mm-hmm.
And he certainly wouldn't want you to worry, because my guess is he loved you as much as you loved him.
Mm-hmm.
Rick, I wish you... I wish mm-hmm. I wish you the best, and I wish you great happiness and peace.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
Nina, we've got to take a short break
mm-hmm.
now, and when we come back, we're going to speak with another hospice nurse and a colleague of yours named Patty, who does a different kind of hospice nursing than you do. We're talking with Nina McKissick. We're talking about end-of-life care and hospice nursing. She's written From Sun to Sun, and she is a hospice nurse. We'll be back after a very short break. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
The Philadelphia Foundation supports WHYY. The Philadelphia Foundation distributes more than $1 million annually in scholarships to southeastern Pennsylvania students. Individuals, businesses, and educational institutions can set up a customized permanent scholarship fund through the foundation and receive tax benefits while helping students achieve their dreams. The foundation helps make it easy by taking care of paperwork and accounting. The Philadelphia Foundation, 215-563-6417 or philafound.org.
I'm Dr. Russell Kaufman for the Wistar Institute, a proud supporter of WHYY. The opening of our new seven-story Robert and Penny Fox Tower has provided flexible, shared laboratory space for the recruitment of scientific teams. Wistar Science is all about scientists with different skills working together, and together they can tackle the most difficult problems facing cancer research. Learn more about Wistar Science at wistar.org. Wistar Science saves lives.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about end-of-life care in the literal sense, caring for those, for ourselves, at the end of one's life. We're joined now by Patty, who, like I said before, before our break, is a different kind of hospice nurse. Patty, thanks for taking the time to join us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you so much, Dr. Gottlieb, for inviting me. And just to correct, I'm not a nurse, but I am a director of a small hospice for the homeless in Washington, D.C., and I work with nurses all the time.
Hi, Patty.
Hey, Nina.
Hello.
Well, you know, the German word for nurse is translated to mean caring sister.
Oh, wow, I love that.
Yeah, yeah. That's the extent of my German vocabulary. So listen, Patty, tell us about your hospice there.
Okay, I'd love to. Joseph's House is a small hospice home in Washington, D.C. for folks who are by and large homeless and dying of AIDS or cancer or heart disease. And we've been serving folks who are homeless and dying here for about 25 years. And I love Nina's book.
Oh,
and
thank you, Patty.
I want to say why. And the reason is that Nina brings her whole self to the care, to the service of the men and women she cares for who are at end of life.
And that's
what we're about.
Yeah, tell us about the population you're working with there and what it's like for you and for them.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're just men and women, like all men and women. And sometimes men and women both who identify as transgender, folks who may be referred to us, everyone, by a hospital or a clinic for the homeless because this person is thought to be at end of life. It could be somebody who has just learned that they have end stage AIDS still in this day and age, and that person could be someone who speaks neither English nor Spanish, doesn't understand really at all the healthcare system she or he is in, and finds themselves to be diagnosed with full-blown AIDS and no context at all for understanding.
What does hospice work look like with that population or a population that can't even speak our language? I wonder if that's a hindrance or a help in some respect.
Here's what it looks like. It looks like a nurse from Joseph's House, maybe a volunteer or even a current resident who's more well, going to the hospital to meet the man or woman being referred. And if that person is in such terrible distress that they are turned to the wall with a sheet over their head, lying in a fetal position, just waiting to die, our nurse and our volunteer or the current resident who's well enough to be with them have the capacity to enter that room and just sit down and wait and just in a way listen from their heart with the heart to the person facing the wall in the bed. And little by little, an opportunity will show itself. Perhaps a hand will come out from under the sheet, and one of us will take it and connect heart to heart until it becomes more possible for a conversation, probably that begins with eye contact, and then picks up with words and with other people in the room, the doctor, the nurse, the social worker, after that. And if that person, and they probably will understand something intuitively about a place they've never heard of before by meeting the hospice nurse and the other person who's there. If they say yes to coming to us, those folks who met them in the hospital room will be there to meet them when the ambulance brings them to Joseph's house.
You know what, Patty? I've just got to stop you. The story you told and the tone in your voice when you told that story, that hypnotic cadence of your voice, I was just about to lose it here.
Oh.
I mean, I just started feeling that ache in my heart at the, you know, the vision of that person lying in a fetal position. But then to just sit there with a loving heart, I mean, I just, I was close to, you know, just dribbling here.
Oh.
So, listen, Patty, I want to thank you so much.
Thank you, Patty.
For the work you
thank
do.
You.
And
thank
for
you.
Taking the time to join us. Nina, is there anything like that here?
No, but boy, would I love to create one.
Okay.
That's how I met Patty. I went there to ask her about it because, you know, she's in a big old house. It has high mileage on it. They need an elevator, but you walk in this place and it is joy.
We got big old houses around here.
I know.
So I want to go to the callers because we've got a lot of callers. I want to talk to Janet on. Hi, Janet.
Hi, Janet.
Janet? No. We might have lost that connection.
I'm here.
Oh, hi, Janet.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Well, I just wanted to get your speaker to address the existence of other forms of palliative care outside of hospice, because I have a terminal cancer situation, and I hang out with other people in my situation, and it's become kind of clear to me that palliative care is available early, you don't have to go into hospice to ask for palliative care.
So yes,
tell us your situation, Janet.
Well, I have breast cancer that is metastasized, and so cure is not part of the program.
And what kind of care are you getting? What kind of palliative care?
I don't know that I would say it's palliative care in the sense that I'm not currently being treated by a palliative team, but it's also clearly recognized that We don't know how to cure this disease. Mm-hmm. And so all of my care is balanced between quality and quantity of mm-hmm. life. Mm-hmm.
So before Janet addresses the issue you want addressed, I just have to ask you, Janet, how are you, your family, your loved ones?
Well, we have our up days and our down days. I think mostly we're pretty good.
Good, mm-hmm. good. Yeah. Nina?
Yeah, Janet, what do you need?
It's not that I need something in particular, okay. but I guess mm-hmm. I just had a very strong reaction to the discussion because
yes.
I have made a lot of friends mm-hmm. since I got into this situation. And so I've heard a lot mm-hmm. about hospice, and I know there are a lot of restrictions that sometimes come with hospice.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's,
and that you know we feel in our community that it's very important for people to understand that mm-hmm. there are palliative teams available
yes.
before hospice.
Yes. All right. Palliative care. You take a chronic disease that's not going to be life-ending. You may be able to live with it for 20, 30 years, like diabetes, like congestive obstructive pulmonary disease, COPD. And palliation is where they do all types of treatments for it. And they're not life-ending conditions. So let's say you get lots of fatigue or something, and you need some blood or something, that's the palliative care team will be doing that. It's different
than
hospice.
What does palliative mean?
It's different than hospice.
What is it? What does...
To palliate, to comfort, it's taking care of people's symptoms, and they could have them for the rest of their lives. It may be a long time, but it's treating the symptoms, possibly curing the disease also. So where you come to hospice is when you're no longer going for the cure, and that's a whole different, it kind of one slides into the other
yeah.
very easily.
Yeah, and they can be independent too, is what Janet was trying
yes.
to say.
Yes.
All right. That clarifies it. Jan, I hope it did for you, and I appreciate your call. I wish you and your family the
mm-hmm.
best.
And mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yes.
Very peaceful times ahead.
Yes.
Thank you.
We haven't had time to talk about your book mm-hmm. at all, but your book was dedicated to your sister, Mary Jane, and mm-hmm. In the chapter that begins with her, you were in sixth grade and you visited her at Greystone Park mm-hmm. Psychiatric Institute.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That has since closed down. Why was she there?
She had cerebral palsy, and in the a long, long time ago, she got very upset and combative when she entered puberty, and they. You know, these days they would never have done that, and they told my mother that she should be institutionalized. So she had this self-soothing ritual where she'd rock herself and sit on the garage floor and rock herself,
mm-hmm.
and they just didn't have many options. My parents did a lot to help her.
You had said though when she was in Greystone,
yes.
you were in sixth grade.
Seventh grade.
In your book, yeah, and you said the last time you had seen her before that she was taken out in a straitjacket.
Right. Yes.
And that was because of these
the
ritualistic
rocking.
Behaviors.
Yeah, the ritualistic.
And,
mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah.
And they put her in Greystone. So what happened?
Mm-hmm. They believe that there's a month. They should be there a month so they can just adjust to the new environment. But whenever I and
but she died in there.
Yes, she. It is a very strong belief that she died there by being my mother 3 years ago before her dementia got really more serious. She's in and out of it. She's 92. She just told me that she wanted to get something off her chest, And she wanted to tell me that my sister was murdered. She didn't die of an asthma attack.
In Greystone.
In Greystone. And then I started researching it, and there were lots of yes. horrible things happened there.
Yeah.
And it was closed down.
Yeah. And, you know, it might in part explain
uh-huh.
how you do what you do and the way mm-hmm. you do
oh,
what
she,
you
yeah.
do.
She was my greatest teacher.
Yeah. Yeah.
Truly.
So you wrote a book about your patients, and tell us about, you know, HIPAA and all that, confidentiality.
Yes, only when you ask for medical information does HIPAA, confidentiality rule, apply. I did not have to do that. With these 21 stories, I asked a few of the patients' families whether if I could find them, if I could use their names, what they wanted me to do. And Ken McKenzie, his son Max, said, please use Ken's names. And actually, that was the hardest one to write because I couldn't take a bunch of stories and put them together to sort of to de-identify them.
Mm-hmm.
So I added one little thing at the end of his story. But son Mac has seen it.
So you didn't have to worry about...
No, and I immediately got an attorney, and she said she read it. She said, no problem.
Hmm.
Yeah.
And you're working on fiction
yes.
now. Based on one of the characters
yes,
in the book.
Yes, the last story.
Yeah, and I wish we had time. I would love to spend more time hearing about the character
oh, yeah.
in your book.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. Nina, I also want to talk to you about your cooking, you know, coming from Italian and Puerto Rican descent. We uh-huh. we got to talk.
I can dance, too.
Yeah. And, you can cook and I can eat. So we got a lot to talk about.
Okay.
So I want to thank you for coming here
you're
today.
You're most
and
welcome. It's an honor to
and
be
I
here.
I want to thank you for the work you do. It's important, human, and humane work. And,
well,
and I just thank you for it.
You're welcome. You're welcome. You
Nina
too.
McKissick is an RN with many years' experience. Her book is From Sun to Sun. It's a memoir of some of her patients. And like she said, those life lessons they have given her. You can follow us at Twitter. We're at Voices in the Fam. Email us at voices@whyy.org. I'm at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Zakiya Gibbons has been our intern. Zakiya, get away from the phones. I want to talk to you. We love you. You've been wonderful. We're going to miss you terribly. And mazel tov on your graduation yesterday. And we're happy to welcome Leah Kaufman, who is young, bright, and enthusiastic. And we're going to fix all those things. Larry Roebling's our producer, who does a wonderful job. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends.